Dangerous Rhythms, Jazz, and the Underworld, author T.J. English explores the symbiotic relationship between jazz musicians and the mob during the first half of the 20th century, and how that mutually beneficial partnership helped the music flourish, but kept the deeply racist attitudes of the day solidly in place. It was a dangerous time for not only the most celebrated black musicians, everyone from Louis Armstrong and Earl Hines to Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday, but also for the biggest stars who weren't black, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, Tony Bennett, and many others. Eventually, everyone had their moment with the mob. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. T.J. English and I recorded the following conversation in August 2023. One of the musicians who epitomizes the relationship that many early jazz musicians had with the underworld is Louis Armstrong, whom English discusses at length in Dangerous Rhythms. Here's Armstrong on a 1928 recording of No Papa No. Struck me as a jazz musician who's been doing this a long time and who thought she knew a lot about the business, and certainly some people, some clubs that I worked in that I knew had some, I suspected had some criminal connections and various, just some dodgy things with record companies, all of this kind of thing. I thought I had a feel for it. And of course, I knew some of the history that was much more involved and than what I went through. Still, this book was a shock to me. I have to tell you how dangerous it was for jazz musicians to be working in some of these places. I always pictured the involvement as kind of separated from the people actually on stage playing. But you describe that so beautifully. It's really frightening to think about. It's hard enough to try to make a living, to try to play the music, to stay in the business, let alone thinking that you have to carry a gun or some of that. Just address that. That was a big surprise for me, the extent of it.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating to hear it from someone like yourself who's in the business, because I do believe for a long time this subject existed as a kind of folk history in the business. I mean, people heard the stories and they thought they knew things about it. But that's why this book was so necessary, I think, to finally take this subject and to go beyond the folk history, to go into the actual history. A lot of this is the oral histories of the musicians who were there and lived it. Of course, one of the problems was that in the time that these events were happening, so starting in the 1920s all the way through into the, let's say, the book goes right up into the 1980s. Very few musicians talked openly about this at the time it was an issue, you know, in the 30s and 40s. Those guys like Duke Ellington and Earl Father Hines and Billie Holiday that were working in those clubs in the 40s and 50s and having to work under the thumb of the criminal element that owned the clubs, they knew better. Father Hines had a saying. It was called the philosophy of the three monkeys. Hear no evil, speak no evil, see no evil. That's how he survived in the clubs. You acted like you didn't see things and you didn't talk about it. And so this was a repressed history for a long time, suppressed history. And where it started to come out to the point where you could think about writing a book about it, was in the oral histories that were done by some of the institutional repositories, Rutgers University, the Smithsonian. They were savvy enough to do a series of oral histories with a lot of aging jazz musicians in the 70s and the 80s and 90s. And a lot of these stories started to come out for the first time. The gangsters and the mobsters were now dead and gone, and the musicians felt they could talk about it. So a lot of that history was preserved in the oral histories. Otherwise, it would have been really tough. I mean, this book should have been written 25 years ago when a lot of these musicians were still alive. It might have been better for it. It was kind of an archival expedition now that most of them were gone. But it was long overdue. I talk to musicians like yourself all the time, and they say a very similar thing. They thought they knew. They heard a lot of the stories, but they had no idea of the true sweep of this history and the reach of the mob in the music business.
It's interesting that you say that they didn't talk about it, and for obvious reasons, because of the danger if they did. But I'm thinking also that you know, it's hard for me to speak as a white person for black people, but I know the ones that I knew Count Basie and the guys in the band and Sarah Vaughan and people like this, they were used to not saying what they were really feeling. It's interesting because this situation tied into the fact that they lived as black people and didn't get to say what they were thinking a lot of the time. And I've always said that about Basie, that he talked just like he played, you know, just a few notes. He would say something, but it would have huge meaning, or it had double meaning. There would be other things like that. But you're actually making me feel better that other people didn't know about this, because I felt really naive. Or I would hear a story like the famous Fats Waller story, which I'll have you tell. And that was always told without Capone, that was always told as kind of a lark, that it was funny. Ha, 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 the Al Capone's men kidnapped Fats and he made a lot of money. And I know I was thinking that had to be scary, but it's never presented that way now. It is in your book. You know, you get the feel of that would be terrifying. So talk about that, because I think that's part of what's disguised the true history.
I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, when I say repressed history, not just forgotten or buried, but repressed, I think for many jazz aficionados, jazz historians, people whose life's work has been to promote jazz and to raise jazz up in the culture, within those spheres of influence, I think there was a certain amount of shame about this history, that this was disreputable history, that this was not the history that we wanted to promote about jazz. And in the effort to bring jazz into the cultural mainstream, to bring it up out of the gutter and out of the mob clubs and the dirty basement clubs and bring it into the forefront of American culture, there was a certain amount of whitewashing that took place in terms of the history of the music, which is unfortunate because it's such rich history and there's so much to learn from it, not just about the criminal underworld and the relationship of the music business to the criminal underworld and how capitalism operated in the business and the racial dynamics. There's a lot in this book about race, about the racial dynamics of the mob's control of the business. But the Fats Waller story, there were certain musicians like Fats Waller and Earl Hines and many others that were particularly savvy at navigating this world, because you had to navigate it. The mobsters not only owned percentages of many of the clubs in the big cities like Chicago, New York, New Orleans, Kansas City, but even mid-sized cities in Denver, San Francisco, of course, in Los Angeles in the 40s and 50s. These were clubs that were owned by the mobsters, and the mobsters came into the clubs. They usually came into the clubs in large groups and they hung out in the clubs. They made their presence felt in the club. So this was a world a demi-monde in which the mobsters and the musicians all kind of circulated together. There's a wonderful movie by Robert Altman called Kansas City that is not a great movie, but it captures a lot of the flavor of that time in Kansas City in the 20s and 30s when this world was in existence. Fats Waller was a master at playing not just for the mobsters, but playing to the mobsters. He was one of those guys like Duke Ellington who understood that there was something about the music of jazz. There was something about jazz itself that was appealing to the underworld figures. It was edgy music. It was daring music. It was sensual music. It crossed a lot of boundaries. It was really on the edge, and the mobsters loved it. They loved it in the way later generations of street people would love rap and hip-hop. It was music that came up from the streets, and it was particularly appreciated by people who were existing at that level. So Fats came more or less from that background and understood that and played to it. He was a great entertainer. I urge anyone who doesn't know who Fats Waller was to go on YouTube and bring up some clips of Fats Waller. He was in movies, and you'll see just what a wonderful, entertaining performer he was.
Waller and his band on Fats's tune, The Minor Drag. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. I'm talking to TJ English about the evening Fats played for Al Capone, an example of the fraught relationships jazz musicians were forced to endure with underworld characters.
So he was playing at a club in Chicago, and this was around 1924-25. Fats Waller was one of the few musicians in the business at that time who was well known enough that he could tour to different cities and headline. He was from New York, but he was playing a series of gigs in Chicago. The story is that one night Capone came into this club with his entourage, and sat down to hear Fats Waller for the first time. And he just, as anyone would, fell in love with Fats Waller. He just thought it was unlike anything he'd heard before. He was dazzled by Fats Waller. Well, the next night, Fats is back at the club playing again, and the entourage comes in without Al Capone. And they wait until a break in his set, and they come up to him and they say, look, at the end of your set, we're going to come and pick you up, and we're going to take you, and you're going to come with us. You don't have a choice on this. You're going to come with us. They kidnapped him, basically. They kidnapped him out of the club at the end of his set. They said, we're bringing you to Cicero, which, for those who don't know, is a suburb of Chicago where Capone's operation was based. We're going to bring you to Cicero. We're going to put you up in a hotel. And over the course of the weekend, you are going to be the musical entertainment at Al Capone's birthday party. And you are going to be the surprise guest. He doesn't know we're bringing you. He's going to love it. And don't argue, because you're going to do this. So Waller later writes about it in a memoir, and he talked about it a lot over the years. He got a lot of mileage out of this story. It scared the shit out of him. I mean, he didn't know what was happening to him. He didn't know if he could trust these people. Well, they took him away. They took him to the hotel in Cicero. He played over the course of the weekend at the hotel. They lavished him with cash, with money. He claims to have left there and gone back to New York with $3,000 in his pocket. This was 1924, 25.
That's 30,000 now. Yeah. Or more. Yeah.
something like that or more. So it was well worth his while. And he had a wonderful story to tell for the rest of his life. But as you say, a lot of these stories seem amusing, and some of them are amusing, except when you think it through and you realize there was real danger at stake here.
What strikes me is, because I have worked with different people, and I remember the time early in my career that a record company guy said, you know, when I said I wasn't going to stay with the label, and he said, there's sharks out there, a little girl like you can't handle it. And I said, you're a shark. And, you know, and I was 22, and I said that, and it was that. But I was dealing with a terrible man, but I wasn't dealing with a psychopath. And there's a big difference. I mean, that's what I'm thinking when you portray these people in this book. These are people that, you know, I don't know, I'm not a killer. But once you've killed lots of people, or once you can do those kind of things, you're not, you know, you're facing a very different situation. And I know years ago, Freddie Green was a close friend, and he told me, it was in a different context, but he talked about the fact, he said, you know, everybody romanticizes the early years of jazz. He said, but for us, he said, you could either, there weren't a lot of options. He said, we could be a criminal or we could be a jazz musician. Now, he said that I had a primary source here, but you made me think about that much more deeply, because you talk about some of these musicians winding up carrying guns to the gig.
Yeah.
So they actually didn't know if something was going to go off. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, there's one thing we need to put out on the table right up front, I think, and it's in the very beginning of the book. You know, I needed to address the subject of how was it that the jazz business got off on this, on the foot that it got off on. And a big part of that was the cultural framework for African-American artists in the earliest years of the 20th century. At a time when Reconstruction was not that long ago, we're only 30 or 40 years removed from Reconstruction. Lynching is still a fact of life, certainly in the South, in Louisiana, where we believe jazz was born, in New Orleans. The state of Louisiana had more lynchings than anywhere in the United States. I posit the theory that the dark cloud from the era of lynching is infused the earliest formations of jazz, that gave it a sense of urgency, that gave the music a sense of urgency and an expression and a deep abiding expression of freedom and a joy of life, that all of that was in jazz from the beginning. That's what made it a phenomenon and made it so exciting. And so the musicians who were creating this almost spontaneously in real time in the streets, places like New Orleans, up from the plantations, and eventually in honky-tonks and clubs. And this is where the Sicilians and the mafia comes into play, because in New Orleans and in other cities, they owned the clubs. And so the mostly African-American jazz musicians were brought into these clubs to make some coin for perhaps the first time in their lives as artists. And they were faced with the reality the clubs were owned by hoodlums. And so the question was, is it worth it? Why would African-American musicians make this deal with the devil, so to speak, from very early on in the business? Well, the point I make in the book is that the average African-American in the early decades of the 20th century had more to fear from a white cop and a white cracker in the street than they did from a mafiosi. That was just the fact of life. And so the mafiosi to the African-American musician represented protection. If I'm going to enter into this perilous, potentially perilous American workplace, where, by the way, we should mention the clubs were mostly segregated, so the audiences were all white. If I'm a black musician and I'm going to find myself playing in these all-white clubs, I need protection. I need to have the biggest, baddest mobster in town fronting for me, standing up for me. And, of course, the guy who understood this better than anybody was Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong embraced this relationship. All his club owners and management personnel were mob figures, were guys who understood the underworld and could operate in the underworld. That's what Armstrong wanted. And that became the model for a lot of musicians. And so that's what I mean when I say that so much of this story is wrapped up in race, race, the concept of race and American capitalism is so deeply intertwined in the telling of how jazz became a commercial entity in the marketplace. Thank you.
remember the first jazz you heard? What hooked you into being a jazz lover?
I'm sure the first jazz I ever heard was Louis Armstrong, because my parents had a Louis Armstrong record. They also were big into Bing Crosby. And they were, you know, I'm Irish American. There was a lot of Bing Crosby around the house. I was enticed by the fact that those guys were friendly, and we had an album that they did together. And, you know, this was in the early 1970s, and the power of Louis Armstrong, who was a black man from the South, and Bing Crosby, who was an Irish American from the Pacific Northwest, the fact that they were connecting in such a joyous way over the music of jazz, I think had a lot to do with making it seem appealing to me.
You've gone fishing.
Now, how do you know?
How do I know? There's a sign upon your door.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone fishing.
I'm real gone today.
You ain't working anymore.
It could be.
There's your hoe out in the sun, where you left a row half done. You told me hoeing ain't no fun.
But I can prove it.
You ain't got no ambition. You gone fishing.
Lay it on me. Lay it on
me. By a shady, weighty pool.
In Shangri-La?
Yes, sir.
Really lie.
I'm wishing, I just could be that kind of fool.
Shall I twist your arm, Papa?
I'd say no more work for mine.
Welcome to the club.
On my door I'd hang a sign. Gone fishing. Oh, instead of just a wishing.
You know, Papa Bing, I've stopped by your place time or two lately, and you weren't home either.
Well, I'm busy, Louie. I got a lot of big deals cooking. I was probably tied up at the studio when you
came
by.
Oh, you weren't tied up, you dog. You were just plain old gone fishing.
Well, now, don't blab it around. Keep it shady, will you?
There's a sign upon your door.
They put that up there again, man.
Gone fishing. You ain't working anymore.
Don't have to work. I got a piece of Gary.
Cows need milk and in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each
but
take
you
a
just
side.
Don't give a darn.
Give 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
See, your phone is gone, Daddy.
Wonder where it went.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side. Gone fishing. Swing it, Daddy. He's a biting and he's high.
Now folks won't find us because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross. We gone fishing,
New Year's,
and said, I'm just a wishing.
But this birthday, but those birthdays, they don't buzz that. Oh, yeah.
Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby on Gone Fishing. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired.
Thank you.
I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. Although we broadcast on NPR stations, we're an independent production, not funded by NPR, but rather by individual donations. Please think of us with your year-end giving and visit jazzinspired.com/donations to chip in and support us. No gift is too small. And please write a review on Apple Podcasts, which is the best way for us to entice others to listen to the show. Thanks for helping us spread the word and celebrate our 25 years on air. For a schedule of upcoming shows and my full concert schedule, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Stride Queen, and visit judycarmichael.com and jazzinspired.com. I'm talking with author T.J. English about his book, Dangerous Rhythms, Jazz and the Underworld, an exploration of the relationship between jazz and the mob in the first half of the 20th century, and how that partnership influenced the evolution of the music and business. Let's jump ahead, and we have what's going on in the clubs in different cities and cities big and small, and all of these tentacles of the mob and criminality, and very often not having to make money with the music because they have gambling, they have other things going on behind it. Did people who got very popular, like a Benny Goodman and some of these people, white musicians, I'll go for some of those, a Glenn Miller, things like that, when the music got as the popular music. There was no arguing with it. Jazz was pop music as it goes. Were they dealing with the mob as well in different ways? Talk about that, because it's all evolving, and I know it's very complex, and we don't have time. That's why people have to read this book to see every way it goes. But I'm curious about that. Address that. I'm curious.
Yes. You know, because you read the book, that there are a number of prominent white jazz figures who came under the thumb of the mob. In that sense, it was really about money as much or more than it was about race. So if someone like Bing Crosby or Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett became popular, yeah, they had to deal with it, particularly those Italian-American crooners. They had to deal with it because they were in close proximity to a lot of the mafiosi. They'd come from some of the same neighborhoods. So, there's some wonderful anecdotes in there about the mob trying to extort money from Bing Crosby. And to handle the situation, he turned to another mobster, which is what most of them did when they were confronted with this kind of situation. To get out from under the thumb, they turned to other mobsters. Of course, there's the story of Joe E. Lewis, who was a singer.
So awful.
Yeah. That's a cautionary tale in the history of American music business, particularly jazz. He's an unknown figure now, but at the time he was very popular in the late 1920s. He kind of came out of vaudeville, and he was type of entertainer who would sing jazz, popular jazz songs of the day, and tell jokes. And he was very popular on the nightclub circuit. And in Chicago, his contract ran out at a club called Green Mill, which is still there, by the way, Green Mill in Chicago. I mean, anyone in Chicago has got to go there on the north side of Chicago. So he said, I'm leaving. You know, my contract is up. I'm leaving. And they said, no, you don't want to do that. And he said, well, I am. And he left. And they let him get started at the other club. He played for a few nights. And then three goons showed up in his hotel room one night with knives. And they set out to kill him, I think. They cut his throat. They stabbed him multiple times. Just a savage, awful attack. He survived it and never really was much of a singer again after that, although he still had a comedy act that he would do. And that was a famous story in the jazz world. That was what could happen if you tried to stand up to the mob. And that's why from that period on, there was a certain amount of fear that all these great musicians had to deal with. You know, you mentioned our guy, Count Basie, who I adore musically, and also just for his joie de vie and the way he carried himself, that guy was in the thick of it. I mean, he played at Birdland at a time when Birdland was owned by a kind of thug, Morris Levy, who was friendly, thought he was a gangster. He wasn't a made man or anything like that, but he certainly was fraternized with gangsters, and he acted like a gangster with the talent, with the musicians. Count Basie worked under the thumb of Mo Levy, and he did just fine, you know? I think he saw the lay of the land and was like, look, this is the way the world is. My job is to try to make this work for me. And many of them thought that way, and those were the ones that had viable careers. And those are the ones, by the way, who wound up playing in Vegas in the 1960s and 70s when jazz had really started to die out commercially, and Vegas was almost the only game in town, certainly the only place where a jazz musician could get like a week-long gig and get paid a lot of money. Those guys who played Vegas, Duke Ellingtons, Frank Sinatras, Nat King Cole's, Count Basie's, these were all guys who played along with that mob-controlled system in the earlier decades.
Holding hands at midnight, neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with one girl, sigh and sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just imagine someone waiting at the cottage door, where two hearts become one. Who could ask anything more? Loving one who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how? At midnight, neath the starry sky. It's nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Strolling with the one girl, sigh and sigh after sigh. It's nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Just think of someone waiting at the cottage door. Our hearts become one. Who could ask for anything more? One who loves you, and then taking that vow. Nice work if you can get it, and if you get it, won't you tell me how?
I think that this template, not just for clubs, but record companies, all the ways that it reached out, at least for me, even with my experience with this, it seems like it's influenced all of it. And you see the big guy, whether it's a criminal or not, the one with the money says, well, this is the biggest game in town. And you're always hearing it now. Actors are dealing with it now with negotiations. But it's sort of, you go with this agent because they have the contacts. And if you don't go with them, you don't get the contract. You don't reach all these people. But now you're stuck with that because maybe it's not the best deal, or the people that you talk about very often, like Mo Levy, you don't get your money. You know, you make the deal thinking this is going to be the thing, or with Roulette Records, Sarah was with them, but then you're not paid. And it fascinates me because you really show how that you could only do in a great book like this, how entrenched it is, because throughout I kept thinking, of different experience I've had that with people that I don't think were, quote, criminals, but still the behavior was the same. Not that somebody had a gun on me.
Oh, yeah.
But there was still this thing of my complaint about jazz clubs and throughout the years, most of the ones that I've worked, has been that they act like I'm lucky to be there. There hasn't been respect. It would be, I've worked a lot in a lot of halls that are mainly classical musicians. And if I'd go to that place, they'd say, please try out our Steinway. I hope it's good enough for you, basically. That's how they treat me. To where if I go to a jazz club and I'm playing, they'll say, well, you know, Hank Jones played this piano. You better do right by us. And they're paying a fraction of what the concert's paying. And I bring it up because this is illustrative for our audience to know what jazz musicians are still fighting against. It's okay to get treatment like that. And it's not okay.
Yeah. One thing is how much this story really is the story of the American music business. And you could even say the American entertainment business. What happened with jazz laid down the template that became the model, certainly for the music business. I mean, you can follow this history right on into rap and hip hop with the thuggery and the shootouts. It's deeply entrenched. There's a lot of reasons for that. Some of it is business. Some of it is cultural, having to do with how and to what extent the music speaks for disenfranchised cultures, how it speaks, how it is the music of the underworld. I always bring up the example of Duke Ellington and who was brilliant on so many levels. But one of the things that's so brilliant about Duke Ellington, I think, is that when he was playing as the house band for the Cotton Club in the late 1920s, and the Cotton Club was a notoriously mobbed up club owned by an Irish gangster named Oney Madden. And, you know, it was a segregated club and it was the cream of the crop. It was the most prestigious club in New York. Ellington is playing in this club that he knows is owned by hoodlums, for playing mostly for entirely white audiences or white audiences who are intrigued by the idea of coming to Harlem and quote unquote slumming with black culture, and that maybe of them are even crossing racial lines and having relationships and sexually. This was all part of the seduction of the music. And you can hear it in Ellington's music from that era. You can hear it in those tunes. I think he knew exactly what this music was being written for, who it was being written for. And he was taking it, this music from the underworld, and symphonically and musically, he was raising it to the highest levels imaginable. He was turning it into America's classical music. It's really a breathtaking accomplishment. But the music never did shake these roots. This business template would exist right up until the 1980s, until the mob itself was sort of taken out by criminal prosecutions and the fact that jazz had begun to die down. But yes, this became the template for the music business. I mean, rock and roll, there's a book called Hitmen about gangsters in the rock business that sort of picks up where this book left off. I mean, I think it's entwined in the nature of American commerce and the role that the mob and the underworld played in American commerce, has played in American commerce ever since the Prohibition era of the 1920s.
Gallington on The Mooch, a favorite recording of my guest, author T.J. English. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. I'm talking with English about his book, Dangerous Rhythms, which discusses the role organized crime played in the development and advancement of jazz. You're very positive at the end of the book, because the question that I was wondering, and then you address it in the conclusion, is if jazz would have survived without this connection, if it would have even become what it is, and is it surviving now, going on with, can it survive? What do you think now?
Oh, that's such a great question and so important. I came to that question. I mean, I'm a jazz lover, and I spend a lot of my time going out and listening to jazz and listening to jazz at home. I live in Greenwich Village in New York near all these wonderful clubs. So I'm often out taking in the music. And so it's a very vibrant fact of my life and has been ever since I've been an adult. I'm not a musician. I'm not having to make my living at it. I'd probably feel different about it if I was. But to me, I half enjoy the fact that jazz is sort of outside the pop culture bubble, that it's not bound by the needs for notoriety and success that other highly commercial forms of music are. Jazz is kind of a wonderful thing that's loved and appreciated by other jazz lovers, and it's something we share. And I don't really care if other people listen to it or not. I mean, I try to get them interested all the time, but it's their loss if they don't know. So I was very aware that jazz is alive and well. And I fell in love with jazz probably when I was a teenager, starting in the 70s, at a time when it was on the down roads commercially. But the beauty of jazz is you can listen to what's out there now, and then you can dip into the vaults and listen to what came before. And any jazz lover does that, you know? And so anyway, I didn't want this book to be a nostalgia piece about this time in history, in the history of jazz. And as interesting as that might be, the question did come to me, so what is the relevance of all this? What does it mean now in terms of the current state of jazz? And what did jazz have to deal with and overcome once these relationships were severed in the 1980s? And as I mentioned in the book, there was a shaky period there. If people remember, jazz in the 80s was not only not commercially popular, it kind of was losing its way a bit. There was a kind of jazz that was highly commercialized called dinner jazz, or what most of us jazz aficionados would refer to as elevator jazz or Muzak. and I'm not going to name names, but a lot of those musicians, you know, cracked the top 40 in the 1980s, and that was what jazz became. And a lot of hardcore lovers of the music were horrified by that. I think one person who was horrified by that was Wynton Marsalis, who started to change the direction of jazz in the 1980s and try to reconnect it to its cultural roots and to celebrate that and to make sure that jazz preserved those aspects of the music that were rooted in the cultural history of jazz. And so in the process of doing that, well, now the clubs were no longer there. The mob had been taken down. The RICO laws, the racketeering laws, had separated the mob from the casino nightclubs in Las Vegas. It had made it no longer financially viable for the mob to own and run clubs. And so a lot of clubs died out. There were probably half as many clubs in the United States of America in the 1970s as there was in the 1920s. It just wasn't the popular music anymore. And so there was a real question there for a while. How will jazz survive without this sort of artificial financial underpinning that came from the mob? And keep in mind, the mobsters who owned the clubs, they were using the clubs as a front to launder money from their other more lucrative proceeds, like narcotics and gambling and other things. The clubs really were just there so they could launder. They were money laundering operations. So jazz clubs weren't burdened with the obligation of having to turn a profit. And this had been great for jazz for a long time. Well, that no longer was there. And now jazz had to make it on its own. And there was a shaky period there. I think what happened is in the 90s is cultural institutions like Lincoln Center in New York and the San Francisco Jazz Center and some other cultural institutions in other cities came into the picture. These are institutions that are financed by wealthy benefactors, jazz lovers, other institutions like universities and whatnot that have money to donate to create these institutions. And so, you know, it was controversial. Some people thought it was turning jazz into something elite. Once you take it out of the smoky clubs, you're turning it into something elite. But I think contemporary jazz, modern jazz for the last 20 years has been walking that line. The old clubs still exist. The Village Vanguard is still here, a couple blocks away from where I live. And you can still go there and soak in the atmosphere of the old clubs. And then you have these great institutions where jazz is treated with the respect that it always deserved.
It's interesting what I'm seeing evolve as I think that jazz is now going to be in a position that classical music has been, because it's going to have people funding it, like you say, have institutions. And yeah, it's interesting because I know in my own fundraising pursuits for this show and for concerts, and I've done a lot of producing, it's interesting to me because I would find that even people who didn't like opera and didn't like classical music, they still got a certain bit of feeling good by donating to it. It made them feel cultured. And I think one of the challenges for jazz is to have people feel good giving money to it, getting more people. I think that's a transition that we're continuing, that people are going to, because I know I've served on a lot of panels at the NEA, things like that. I've seen over the years this transition of, no, jazz needs money, people. It can't just be in these smoky clubs. People go, well, it isn't jazz. The very thing you're talking about. And I think that's a transition that we're going through, as well as the people that are coming up now that all have degrees in jazz, which didn't exist before, they're having the same problem that a lot of my friends in the classical world had, is that they came up, they got their degree, they expected a career, and then they thought, wait a minute, there's only a few people who get a career. How am I going to be entrepreneurial to get a career? And I know I'm seeing a lot more of that with younger musicians, more of this understanding of social media, producing their own concerts. I think it's an interesting transition that we're in. But one of the things that you said that I just loved is that you've liked that jazz has been not part of the commercial, popular, whatever we want to call it, world, because I do think that does keep the music pure in a certain way, because you have to really want to do this to do it. It isn't just the passion of the music carrying you through. You're looking, and I've said this to actor friends of mine, I say, the chances of you becoming Meryl Streep are pretty remote, but you could get a TV series and get rich. Jazz musicians pretty much know they're not going to get rich. And that does call the herd, you know? That does keep it down to a much smaller group that are going to last. this has been such a great conversation. I'm a huge fan. I love the book. This was such a joy. I told you that one of your fans sent it to me. So it shows you that some of these connections that you don't expect will happen. And I just loved it, and that you took the time to be on the show. Thank you so, so much.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. It's a joy to talk about the music. It's a joy to talk about the music with someone who is a practitioner of the music, much less someone who, you know, understands the cultural history of it. And I love the fact that you heard about it through word of mouth from within your circle of jazz lovers and jazz friends, because that is jazz. That is how we learn about it. That's how we learn about it. It's not the internet necessarily. It's not pop culture. You're not going to see a billboard somewhere about the latest album from your favorite jazz musician. It's going to be word of mouth amongst the true jazz fans.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. You've been listening to my conversation with TJ English. I hope you'll join me here next time when I talk with another creative person about how jazz inspires their life and work. I'm Judy Carmichael, the host and producer of Jazz Inspired. My production engineer is Curtis Heidoff. You can download podcasts of Jazz Inspired from all platforms and listen at jazzinspired.com. Our opening music was Airmail Special, and the mid-break music is a smooth one from my CD, High on Fats and Other Stuff. The closing music is Old Fashioned Love from my CD Trio. I'm on piano with Mike Hashem on sax and Chris Flory on guitar. It's end-of-year donation time. Although we broadcast on NPR stations, we're an independent production not funded by NPR. We're funded primarily by your donations. So please visit jazzinspired.com to chip in. No gift is too small. And exciting news! We've received a $10,000 matching grant offer if we can raise that amount before the end of the year. Please visit jazzinspired.com/donations to chip in and keep us going. For more information on upcoming shows and my touring schedule, visit jazzinspired.com and judycarmichael.com.